Rana, and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for making it at a very, very short notice. There's a lot of excitement in the air. And it's wonderful. This is Nishit Desai, those who are on the phone. I'm delighted that you all have joined over phone and to discuss this. Also, to start with, I'm the founder of Nishit Desai Associate. This is our 25th year of our law firm, and as you know, that we have been driven by a lot of research, academics, thought leadership, and stuff like that, long period of time. And today I have with me Aishwarya, who is a corporate lawyer, and Stax, and Mihir Parikh, who is a strategic thought leader, and also on phone is Mansi Seth. She is leading her practice in the U.S. from our New York office. She has also joined the international tax and funds and corporate lawyer. So we are all here. As I was mentioning, so I'm the founder and the head of the organization, and all these are the brains of the organization along with me, and it's wonderful to be talking on this subject. Most of you have now come across this news on the new protocol that has been now signed between India and Mauritius, modifying the tax treaty that existed since 1983. So it's almost 33 years of the treaty. Often treaties don't last that long, but we had fortunately a situation where the treaty remained for a long period of time. That shows our relationship, political, cultural, historical ties that we have between India and Mauritius. Many of you may or may not know, but almost 59-60% of Mauritius's population is of Indian ethnic origin. And many Indians went as sugar farm workers and then stayed on, and it's almost third generation must be today. Fourth generation, and we enjoy a very good friendly relationship, you know. And when there is a treaty, generally it is reflective of the good relationship between two countries. Okay. So as I mentioned, this treaty was signed in 1983, and but it did not, you know, become very popular for use by investors until early 1990s. And if you recall, India went through kind of a near bankruptcy stage in 1989. India's foreign exchange reserves were to the bottom. India borrowed money to survive by pledging gold and stuff like that. And in 1991, 21st of June, India opened up to foreign investment. And when India opened up to foreign investment, it was a big bank reform first time India saw. Prior to that, India was very insular and protectionist. But in 1991, India opened up to foreign investment, and almost 90% of the sectors of economy were opened up to foreign investment for 100% investment, and more on automatic basis. I remember this is, I did my law in 1973, by the way, and in 1977, I did my master's with international business law and globalization, stuff like that. But we exactly know how strangulating the environment was in those days. So I remember that if you had to invest in India, often it took 2 years, 3 years for approval to come in. If you get it in 1 year, you're lucky. Everything was what is called license raj. That means for every small thing, you needed a license from the government. And that was, you know, actually impeding the investment for coming in, and rather than, you know, getting more and more open up. So it was 1991, 21st of June, India opened up to foreign investment. And as I said, being a research-based law firm, we do a lot of research on comparative law and things like that. And I was, you know, trying to understand where from maximum investment will come into India. And obviously, the answer was the U.S. Okay. So while doing comparative studies, I came across your famous code, Section 865, Internal Revenue Code, which basically says that if U.S. resident makes investment, say, in a country like India, in the shares of an Indian company, and earns capital gains, it is considered U.S. source income. Okay. Because for the purpose of income tax, the status of the shares is considered to be for Indian, U.S. Tax, I believe, and I'm not an expert on U.S., but that's what we found, was that if you are a U.S. resident, the source of income is where, especially for capital gains on sale of foreign company, where the holder of securities rights. So from U.S. perspective, if you earn capital gains, it was considered U.S. source income, and therefore U.S. said that we have first right to tax this income. On the other hand, India said that the gains that you're earning are of an Indian company shares. So according to us, India has first right to tax because the source of income, capital gain is U.S., India. Now, the problem was a tax treaty that was signed between India and the U.S. that was signed in 1990 and it became effective in 1991 said that both countries can tax capital gains in accordance with their own laws. So they did not resolve this whole issue completely. And there are some complicated flipping ways and stuff like that to get tax credit, etc. But, you know, U.S. is always a little more complicated, you know, it's not always very easy. And tax rates in India often are such that excess foreign tax credit in the U.S. may also lapse. So this was broadly a big problem. So when we found that in India you have to pay tax rate of about 25% on long-term capital gains to close to even 50% on short-term, in 1991 and prior to that. And if you have to pay tax again in the U.S., which was possibly 40% per state level or the city level kind of tax, then, you know, there'll be significant overload of taxation, maybe 50, 60, I don't know what number, it could be 70 those days. And so who will invest if there is so much of taxation? And particularly in the context of tax-exempt investors, okay, like pension plans and endowments and others, the difficulty was that they are tax exempt and you still have to pay tax in India, and you know, then again it becomes at times a non-starter unless India gives good returns, both not only in terms of rupee terms but also in dollar terms. You know, it will be very onerous for people, and that, you know, people would, at that point of time, we had just come out of, as I said, near bankruptcy stage, people would always have a little concern about the exchange rate fluctuations and stuff like that. So when we found this problem, you know, we began to look for some solution. And we tumbled on this treaty between India and Mauritius. And by looking at it, I said, this is strange. In most treaties, India has either said both countries will tax according to their own laws, or India will have right to tax first. Okay. But here, it is that it is Mauritius which will have right to tax capital gains. Because India never thought that Mauritius will ever invest in India. We always thought that India is only going to be investing in Mauritius. So India extracted a provision in the treaty that, look here, if Indian companies invest in the in Mauritius, only India will have right to tax, because they only thought that India would be invested. At that time, companies like SR and Bajaj Scooter and many other ones and textile mills, and, you know, Indians were investing in Mauritius. But when you write any particular agreement, you also have a reciprocal. So here what happened was Mauritius given right to tax capital gains under the treaty between India and Mauritius and not India. Okay. So that was the beginning of the discussion. Most welcome. Thank you. So, so actually what happened was that Mauritius had this particular favorable tax treaty provision, but it did not have offshore regime. So when I looked at, when we looked at Mauritius for investment in India, one of the things was that first question was whether American investors or others can go to Mauritius, set up a company in Mauritius and invest in India or not. Okay, that was one of the challenges. So some or the other, when I looked at this treaty, I said, oh, where is Mauritius? First of all, that question, it's a small little island in Indian Ocean, Mauritius, Malta, Maldives, everything. If you're not visited these places, it looks similar, you know, and you have just no idea as to what's happening. And so when I went to Mauritius, asked some people, can American companies or others can invest in India through Mauritius, they said, we don't have offshore regime. And at that point of time, I started talking to the minister in Mauritius and other people, and eventually they said, okay, we should set up offshore financial center. And I said two things. I said, first, you do not want to be another grubby island on a planet, okay, because, you know, there are many offshore centers and stuff like, you don't want to get a bad name. So your KYC norm should be the strictest. Some of you who have tried to invest in India through Mauritius must have gone through all this heavy KYC process, right? They look at everything in life, you know, and then allow you to set up a company. Second thing I suggested strategically was that focus on fund industry, because, you know, reputation comes with institutional framework. So two differentiators were carved out in the beginning, that strictest KYC norms, and number two, focus on the fund industry to start with. Of course, then there is arrangement for private companies and other ones, but focus was on the fund industry. And
fund,
venture capital fund, private equity fund, institutional. So we said your focus should be on getting fund industry into Mauritius so that it gets reputation automatically. You know, if it's a private closed companies, sometimes there are questions like you saw Panama Papers and stuff like that. It's not that everything done in Panama is illegal, but at the same time, somebody from Panama Press, it looks like. So the thing is that, you know, idea was that to get quick reputation in the marketplace, global marketplace, it was important that you create institutional. Then other companies and other entities can be set up. And then got engaged with the government of Mauritius, closely worked with them, help them, you know, change the tax rules and the corporate and other kind, created a framework for developing an open, transparent regime for offshore investment activities in Mauritius. So today, it is considered to be a very reputed jurisdiction. Another thing, we kept exchange of information, okay, because if anybody is trying to do money laundering otherwise, then India and Mauritius can easily exchange information, and Mauritius has been very proactive because they do not want any kind of a bad name for protecting the hidden money and stuff like that. Not only that, Mauritius has also allowed Indian tax official to sit in Mauritius in case when there are any irregularity, anything is found. So that is why India and Mauritius have very good relationship, and that the treaty that was then suddenly began to be used from mid-1990s. And as I mentioned that we helped Mauritius government develop this offshore financial center and eventually set up very first company there. That was for Bombay, it was Bombay Fund Limited, sponsored by Barclays, this is a trade investment management company. Second company was Alliance Capital, the India Liberalization Fund. Third company was George Soros and Chase Capital, first private equity fund we set up, then Walden Nico was the fund. So initial companies and regime was set up, but every time what we did kept on the back of our mind openness, transparency, robust structuring and stuff like that. Because often we talk about structures, but structures are only one part of the game. More important thing is the architecture. Sometimes you do right thing, but it has to look aesthetically good as well. You understand the difference between structural engineer and the architect, right? So both are important. You have to have a robust structure, but at the same time, it must look. So sometimes you have done a great structure. We all go on whiteboard and do structure, but if you do not keep in mind, how do you present, how do you recite? Because structure ultimately gets translated into a document, right? So when tax department or anybody would look at, they are not just going to look at the structure. They are going to look at what have you written in the actual document, whether it is a placement memorandum or it's a constitutional documents of a company or board minutes. So everything has to be done in a manner that it looks decent and at the same time it is legally compliant. So we've been very careful in, and that is even becoming more relevant today because more and more countries are now introducing what is called general anti-avoidance regulations, GAR popularly called, you know. And more countries are also looking at substance over form. In fact, in India for a long period of time, we always looked at form over substance. Even the US has been looking more substance many times, but in India, it was a clear rule that form prevails over substance, okay? And the reason for that was also in a, historically, you know, you only look at the language of the law, okay? It is government's job to write a clear law. How can a citizen decide his behavior, okay, unless law is properly written? So if you have not properly drafted law, then benefit should go to the citizen, okay, and government should not take that. So that was the rule for a long period. Even today, it is more or less same rule, but now India is going to introduce general anti-avoidance regulations from next year. And that is 1417. And irrespective of all that, we felt that whether law requires or not, let us make all the structures aesthetically looking good. And also, so when you look at a story, you don't really, you know, think that there's something fishy or something, somebody's just abusing the whole law. So you create those kind of things. So, so over a period of time, you know, now it has become more clear that, you know, you have to have substance and robust structure as well, you know. Now, this was early 1990s and worked on. By and large, government supported the treaty. But what happened was that tax department even challenged the use of treaty. And actually, it was not tax department. Let me step back for a moment. There was a very interesting case called Azadi Bachao Andalan. Azadi is freedom. Bachao means save. Save Our Freedom movement, that was a not-for-profit like organization. They went to the Delhi High Court and the Supreme Court saying that this treaty is being abused. People are coming to India, to, you know, just a facade company and stuff like a lot of kind of allegations went in. And this was probably interesting. Now, interestingly, what happened was that this challenge was against the government, okay, that this this treaty should be revoked, this is, you know, not fair, this, that, whatever it is. But Supreme Court clearly said there is nothing wrong in third country residents like the U.S. to come to Mauritius and invest in India, either legally or morally. Very, very clear. And we represented all the global foreign investors who invested in India through Mauritius. And we said that if you want to deny benefits of a tax treaty, you must have what is known as limitation of benefits article. Limitation of benefits means benefits will be limited only to certain class of people who own Mauritius company, you know. If you do not have that, then anyone can set up an entity in Mauritius, even though it may be paper box company, but company itself is an artificial entity in the eyes of law. It is not, it is nothing. So artificiality is the beginning of the end. Okay. And so Supreme Court eventually gave a very clear ruling sometime in 2004 that if you do not have what is called limitation of benefit article in the treaty, you have to allow the benefits of the treaty, so long as the entity has tax residency certificate from Mauritius government. So in Mauritius, you know, the tax department issues tax residence certificate. And in fact, I remember very first company also we had set up, I had written tax residence certificate in my own handwriting. Just for, it was very early stage of. Now, what happened was that Supreme Court gave this ruling. So it was 2004. And then after, you know, it was always anticipated that government may amend the treaty. Lucky we are, there are another 12 years have gone by, and now treaty is sought to be actually amended. Okay. But in this particular case, it was government which defended the use of tax treaty by third country residents, okay, and they also said that even if it's paper box company, even if it's shell company, benefits of the treaty will be allowed so long as Mauritius gives a tax residence certificate. So by and large, all the case laws that have developed, I argued a case for Blackstone just some time ago, and again, courts have held the same thing, that benefits of the treaty have been allowed. And of course, you always have a good, these are all public knowledge, so I can talk about it. But interesting thing is that India has adhered to the rule of law. Both countries have implemented the tax treaty in good faith. The treaties have to be implemented in good faith. And now the treaty has been amended. What has been provided in that is that henceforth, India will have also right to tax gains that arise from sale of Indian company, even if it's a Mauritius resident. Okay. So now they have reallocated the taxing rights. Earlier, taxing right was only to Mauritius when Indian shares were sold, and Mauritius, there is no capital gains tax. Okay. Because income is conceptual in a way that capital gain is not an income. It's basically tax on inflation, right? It's tax on the appreciation, right? So, but over a period of time, you know, countries have introduced rules to say, okay, capital gains will be deemed to be an income. Income means what regularly comes to you, okay, something like that. So, Mauritius, there is no tax. In India, there is no tax because Mauritius companies are taxable at the taxing rate is only with Mauritius. Okay. Most people did not understand why U.S. companies should invest in India through Mauritius, because there was double taxation on the same income, as I explained in the beginning. So when we set up first entities, our intention was not to avoid tax, but to avoid double taxation on the same income. We all know that if you invest in India through a Mauritius company, okay, there is no capital gains tax in India. There is no capital gains tax in Mauritius. But when you bring money back home, you still pay tax. You know? So most people stopped. And in newspapers and all other media, they would say, oh, people get away from taxation in India, Mauritius, and, you know. But real fact is that the whole objective was to see that at least tax only one end, not the other end. That was the whole genesis of whatever that happened. Interestingly, over a period of time, almost 46 to 47% of FDI in India came through Mauritius. Okay. So it was a huge investment. Both countries had a lot of stake in. Every time government of India tried to renegotiate, market went down. Okay. And therefore, again, the negotiations were being postponed or whatever it is, right? Now, situation is that when we had tax rate ranging from 25% to at times even 50% short term, right, in 90s, early 90s, there was a need to reduce the rigors of the taxation in India. At that point of time, Mauritius came very handy. What has happened in last couple of years is interesting. India has reduced its taxation level to maximum 35% on regular income on corporates. On capital gains, the tax rate was almost 22%. It is now being brought down to a level of 10%. Okay. Number two, if you have the shares of an Indian company that is listed on a recognized stock exchange in India, and you earn long-term capital gains, there is zero tax in India. So again, if you look at the regime in last some years that has emerged, is that taxes have come down significantly. Okay, so at a macro level, the picture is much better than what it was. So for last 20 years, Mauritius came handy where the tax rates were very high in India and you could reduce taxes and therefore, you know, you can make the whole business workable and viable. But now again, the relevance of capital gains tax is also getting slightly reduced. I'm not saying completely irrelevant because tax rates have become 10% in case of publicly listed companies, long-term capital is zero tax. So, you know, there is no use of Mauritius if you're investing in a public company in some ways, right? So that is how the things have changed. Mauritius has contributed a lot to India. India has maintained good relationship with Mauritius, and rule of law really prevailed consistently. If you remember, all said and done, you know, tax department became very aggressive in last some 10, 20 years. Everybody knows. I don't think many of you would be unaware of it. And but that was the time when countries like Mauritius came very handy. In fact, we all know that what happened to Vodafone case. Most of you know that we were, you know, special counsel to Vodafone also at, when things were happening. But if you look at ultimately, Supreme Court decided in favor of Vodafone. And then after retrospective amendments were brought in, and it is susceptible to two challenges. One can challenge constitutional validity of the retrospective amendment. That matter is still there. Number two, Vodafone could also invoke what is called bilateral investment protection treaty. It is slightly different from the tax treaty, and the treaty would basically say that if the foreign investor has to be put to adverse regulation compared to what is expected, then investment will be protected. Now, in case of retrospective amendment, what had happened in case of Vodafone, what had happened was that Vodafone had invested through a Dutch PV. Now, Netherlands and India have a good, not really tax treaty, but more importantly, bilateral investment protection treaty. The treaty also says that Netherlands will have the benefit of not really Dutch-India protection treaty, but also if any other treaty is more favorable than Netherlands, it will also. Kuwait and India have a good tax protection treaty. Unfortunately, India and the U.S. do not at this point in time have a bilateral protection, which is again another subject matter of discussion. So if you look at the, but Mauritius is very good treaty. In fact, it is one of the best negotiated bilateral investment protection treaty. So forget about tax for a moment. But use of Mauritius for non-tax purposes, that is for protection of investment, is also an important element, if you put it that way. And the difficulty, I think when Mr. Modi and Obama, I think, are going to meet next month, there's some pressure at the moment to have this bilateral investment protection treaty. But if you look at fund manager, let's say, in the U.S., he has some kind of fiduciary responsibility to the investors. Okay, investors would include pension plans and other people, the small people behind that. So what is his first duty? India may be giving great returns, but important thing is that is the investment protected? Okay. If your fund manager or anybody is, you know, kind of a trusted advisor, first thing I would say, I'll give you 100% interest on a, give me a loan, right? But what we do, whether my basic capital is protected or not, right? That's the first question a manager or a person would ask. So one way in which so far we have taken a position is that Mauritius is used just not only for the purpose of tax, you know, let's say avoidance or tax, exemption, but also for protection of the investors who come to India. So today that we the whole investment is little bare, you know. So BPI is very important part of the whole game. So now, given the fact that now Indian government has and Mauritius both have agreed to change the terms of the treaty through the protocol, what does this protocol do? Protocol now says that if you invested in India through Mauritius, we will continue to grandfather your investment, and there is no problem whenever you sell the shares. So existing investments will be all protected. Number two, if you make investment up to 31st of March 2017, that also will be protected. So you, anytime you sell the shares in India, you'll be protected by the Mauritius India tax treaty. Number three, if you invested in India through a Mauritius company between 1st of April 2017 and 31st of March 2019, so if you invest and exit during this period, then India will tax you only at 50% of the capital gains that normally would apply. Now, tax rate in India has already come down to a level of 10% on long term. Okay. So if you invested in India after 31st of March 2017 and before 31st of March 2019, in 2 years, you know, you will still be entitled to exemption but at half the rate. And after 2019, you will be taxed at the regular rate. Okay. Regular rates, as I mentioned, have come down from a level of 22% to almost now 10%. Okay. And so it, the rigors are a little lower than what we used to see. So this is the main crux of the tax treaty today. And therefore, we need to now see how you can go about. And we will have some, what are the new structures and what are the new things that perhaps one could think of. Second important thing that has been provided in the treaty is reduced tax rate on interest paid from India. Currently, if Indian company pays interest to a foreign company or foreign entity, tax rate is close to about 22%. Okay, in some cases it is even 40%. Okay, when it is rupee denominated loan, the rate of tax is 40%. Dollar denominated for 22%. Okay, what this treaty do? It has reduced this tax rate to a level of 7.5%. So if you have to invest in India through Mauritius now, you pay 7.5%. If you invest through Singapore, it's, I believe, 15%. Netherlands is about 10 or 15%. US is almost, I think, 15%. So Mauritius now becomes an interesting jurisdiction from interest tax reduction perspective. So assume for a moment you have so far been making investment by way of an equity, and therefore you have capital gains on equity shares. But if you now use convertible debenture as an instrument, the tax rate on interest will be only 7.5%. On the other hand, when Indian company pays this interest, it will also be deductible as an expense interest. Correct. If you invest in the shares of a company in India, and if dividends are paid by Indian company, dividends are not tax deductible item. On the contrary, when you declare dividend from India, there is about 18-20% tax on dividend distribution tax, because the Indian system works as follows. Indian companies pay tax at the rate of close to 35%, 34 point something. And after that, when you have post-tax profit of, say, 65, and if you distribute that as dividend, there's additional tax of close to 20%. So another 10%, let's say, goes away. So 35% plus 10%, the effective tax rate comes to almost 45%. You obviously see it on excess foreign tax credit in the US. You don't get full tax credit for those kind of things, right? So there are issues to equity as well, maybe. and you know US law better than I know. But this is that. In India, under exchange control regulations, not for the tax purposes, for exchange control purposes, convertible, what we call mandatorily convertible or compulsorily convertible debentures are deemed to be equity investment. That means they are treated at par. So if you are allowed to invest in Indian company shares on an automatic basis without, say, governmental approval, you can also use compulsorily or mandatorily convertible debenture as an instrument in invest in India. You know, so for exchange control purposes, currency control purposes, both are treated at par. But for tax purposes, the convertible debenture is considered to be debt until such time it is converted into the shares. Am I with you? Convertible debentures, until such time you convert, are considered to be a debt. And you can have number of permutation combinations in this convertible debentures. It is not that you have to charge a fixed rate of interest. You can link up with the performance of the company and say, okay, X percent of the profits of the company or Y percent of the upside or whatever it is. You can build a lot of kind of interesting elements into that particular instrument. So convertible debentures now would become more popular to invest in India. And as of now, we do not have thin capitalization rules, by the way. Maybe they will come because we learn from the U.S., you know. U.S. has become the largest exporter of laws, regulations, policies. So, you know, we learn a lot from you. And, you know, so somewhere it might come. But at this point in time, we don't have precise thin capitalization rules. And although we have transfer pricing regulations, so combined with transfer pricing regulations, combined with exchange control regulations, and combined with the other corporate laws, you can create very interesting instrument for investing in India. And so interest tax deduction is very, very important now. Where earlier, to invest through convertible instrument was a little difficult from Mauritius. So what people did, people used Cyprus, which had 10% tax rate on interest. But Cyprus treaty has been denotified, by the way. And similarly, Singapore has a little higher rate of tax, but still people used it because 22% tax was slightly higher, you know. And for rupee-denominated loans, 40% tax rate on the foreign companies was imposed. So 40% interest rates were too high. So all that has come down to 7.5%, which is creating an interesting situation for. Very interestingly, India does not, as of today, have good debt markets. It's very shallow. We expect that debt market would now pick up because not only from tax perspective I'm talking, but even general also, government is trying to encourage now development of debt market. So it is making it more convenient for people to make rupee denominated loans and subject to some conditions, that's fine. And India was very averse to loans or foreign debt at one point of time, very stringent, but now it is relaxing the whole thing. And debt market could be trillions of dollars, right, one would put it, and very interesting market which you are all familiar with. So we expect that Mauritius will also become interesting for debt funds as we move forward, and this is another interesting part that's happening. Third interesting situation is that the treaty talks about taking away benefits of capital gains tax, you know, in relation to shares. But in relation to derivative instruments, it is still not taken away, you know. So there are non-share instruments which still be, the right to tax will be only with Mauritius. Okay. So there's another interesting thing that one can, you know, look at. So if you instrument other than shares, you know, possibly, you'll, for example, debentures. You sell the debentures, what happens? It's not the sale of shares. Okay, so that may Again, the treaty is new. Interpretations are still coming out, but our thinking is that that would be another way to do it. So before the debentures, you know, become convertible, you sell it one day before. But what is it? Okay, it may be still capital gains, but not on the sale of shares. Okay, so there are various interesting opportunities that still remain within the framework of Mauritius Treaty. Second thing is that there are foreign portfolio investors and the FIs, what they used to call. For them, the P note, there is little ambiguity on the P note at this point in time. And, you know, that is what I've already raised an issue on that with the government or other people. And that remains to be seen how government is going to react on that. So I would not go too much into detail on the P notes, but that is one area where there will be some clarification that would be required. So these are few aspects as far as Mauritius is concerned. We constantly confront a question, oh, whether we should go to Singapore or Netherlands. Okay. And now, what has happened is that Singapore did not have this capital gains tax kind of an exemption under the treaty. And sometime in early 2000, when Supreme Court decided case in favor of Mauritius, so to say, Singapore government also approached government of India and said, you've given all these benefits to Mauritius, why not to us? So government of India, India and Singapore have very good, again, political and economic and other ties closely. So government agreed that, okay, we'll grant you similar exemption, just as is available in Mauritius, but subject to a couple of conditions, that your company should incur minimum of 200,000 odd Singapore dollar expenditure in 2 years prior to the sale of instrument. You know, it should not be pure shell company, and there are other kind of conditions. So there is some kind of limitation of benefit article in Singapore treaty, which was not there in Mauritius. So when Singapore was granted benefit, these were the conditions imposed by government. But one interesting provision government of India put, that if we take away benefits of capital gains from Mauritius, then Singapore benefit will automatically fall out. So same thing that 1st of April 2017, when the treaty undergoes change, the Singapore treaty benefits will go away. And issue is that the interim period that is going to be there, where you have half the rate of tax, 17 to 19, right? 2017-19, that rate will not be available to Singapore. What we hear is that, and I believe Mr. Hasmukh Adia, who the, you know, friend secretary, he has indicated that we might renegotiate with Singapore. So that is still going to be renegotiated. I do not know how it will unfold, but whenever there are renegotiation, you know, they are always, it's time-consuming, say, rounds of discussions and delegations go back and forth and so on and so forth. So there are many funds that move to Singapore, they would be confronted with this particular question. Okay. Singapore, again, is very interesting jurisdiction, and to establish substance was little easier for many companies because many had already existing operations, and spending $200,000 was not a big issue. But Singapore's position are always there that we are not competing with Mauritius. We have our own set of business environment, our own regulations, so people come on our own merit. So Singapore is not in that sense competing with Mauritius. But for investors who are investing in India, they try to compare these jurisdictions. And if you want to set up funds in Singapore, your cost would be easily million and a half or something like that, because you have to get approval from MAS, Monetary Authority of Singapore. You have to have 3 employees with some qualifications. You have to have some other expenses and stuff like that. And it takes a few months to get approvals and, you know. So Singapore stands on its own, but just purely from tax perspective, this is the consequence. So Mauritius, in lighter wind, people say those who remain loyal to Mauritius, they have been now rewarded because they'll get 50% tax rate between the two periods. So that's the other thing.
And also,
Sorry?
Nishant, just to add to what Nishant said.
Lisa, New York office. Please, your expert
yeah,
comment.
I thought I'll just add in also on that whole Singapore point, it's not just about the beneficial rate, even the grandfathering, we are not sure at this stage whether, because the treaty itself or the protocol of the Singapore-India treaty doesn't talk anything about grandfathering. It simply says as soon as the benefits under India-Mauritius tax treaty fall away, they would also fall away for the purposes of India-Singapore treaty. And because of the way the new protocol between India and Mauritius is worded, it specifically says that the investments under 1st April 2017 are grandfathered or they are protected and you can exit at any point of time. But if at this stage you were to literally see the protocol and the treaty between India and Singapore, falling away of benefits would be immediate from 1st April and the protocol doesn't talk anything about grandfathering any investments. So there is a potential of even the existing investments being impacted as far as Singapore is concerned. Of course, as Nishit mentioned, they're looking into it. They might renegotiate, and when we're probably going to hear in the next few months about how they will tackle this situation.
I think, thank you for intervention, Mansi, and it's a very important point I missed out talking about, that, you know, even now it is a little uncertain what happens, okay? Our feel is, and Mansi perhaps will agree, that more likely than not, government will not put people who invested from Singapore in a jeopardy, you know.
Yeah,
but this, at this point in time, this is the interpretation, okay. So that is one part of, so Singapore treaty exempted capital gains, interest rates were lower for Singapore compared to other jurisdictions, so people use that as well. So that is about Singapore. Third jurisdiction, which is very interesting, is Netherlands. Okay. And India-Dutch treaty provides that if a Dutch entity owns, I believe, 10% or less investment in an Indian company, it is considered as a like portfolio investment. And if Dutch entity sells those shares and earns capital gains, there'll be zero tax, number one. So portfolio investment is not taxed. Other provision is that if a Dutch entity sells shares to another non-resident entity, irrespective of the fact whether Dutch entity owns more than 10% or not, it will be still exempt in India. So Dutch entity to another Dutch entity or another non-resident entity, so far as the sale of shares happens between two non-residents, Dutch treaty provides for complete tax exemption. Okay. So the result is that if Dutch entity owns more than 10% and sells to a resident of India, that is the only thing that is being taxed. Got it. So, therefore, subject to this limitation, now Dutch treaty would also become more interesting, and to again renegotiate the whole treaty with Netherlands would take some years. You know, it may not happen overnight. You know, and beg your pardon. Yeah, who knows? Yeah. So, Netherlands is becoming very interesting, and interestingly, Netherlands also has good investment protection treaty with India. As I mentioned, Vodafone has actually used it at this point in time. So, you know, and especially for P-notes and other kind of structures, you know, Netherlands will become more interesting now. So, you know, those are FPIs and FIs. They will be, I think, it might move to Netherlands. Who knows? But the thing is that it appears that because there is some ambiguity in relation to the P-note structures and, you know, taxation of that, there may be some restructuring that might happen. Or other entities which, you know, have to use, perhaps Netherlands become an interesting jurisdiction. So these are the nuances of the change in protocol. And as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, the world is becoming more transparent and open, and it's very important to bear in mind that whatever you do will be on the front page of newspapers tomorrow morning. If you can withstand the scrutiny of law, of media, you are there. Like Starbucks and Apple and everybody went to Ireland and to the UK and all that, you remember? Even though there was no tax payable, public uproar, okay, caught up and they say, okay, we'll pay some tax. So there is a concept of moral tax now, which is nothing really, but it's coming up. And tax is not a charity, it was always said. But now people say, okay, we pay a little tax just because public wants it, you know. So there are very interesting situations that are coming up. And as I mentioned that within this whole ever-changing world, you know, we have to also constantly be on toes and see how best we can do. Sometimes you do right things but wrong way. If you do right thing but don't write it properly, I think you get into deep trouble. So it's very important that both in terms of conceptual structures or otherwise, you know, it's very important to have a translation of that structure into a good documentation. What are some of the things that you might want to do when it comes to documentation? Until recently, you know, you said, okay, here's agreement, you draft agreement and say, we are going to set up this company, blah, blah, blah. But now your recitals will become very important. Recitals are the kind of introductory part of any agreement. So if you are using any of these tax structures, try to build in real story in your introductory part, okay? That if you're using Mauritius, you're using Singapore, then try to bring why are you also using Mauritius or Singapore or other jurisdiction. For example, you say, whereas Mauritius and US and India do not have bilateral investment protection treaty, and therefore we are doing this non-commercial, non-tax commercials can be built into at that point. We know that that is a fact. But if you do not write it, and after 6 years or 5 years, when tax department will raise, why did you invest through Mauritius, you know? Then you say, oh, there is no bilateral investment protection treaty between India and the U.S. Oh, we did it. It's all makeup story, looks like. But if you write it today, then you already have a story right there. So recitals in every agreement are becoming very important, not only from Indian perspective, but I would be from a global perspective, because people want to know why you are doing what you are doing. And many a times we remain silent on those issues, and I would recommend that it's very important to have, you know, your documentation very carefully crafted, including PPMs, for example, we say. So it tells me that I should stop now, I think. So I will stop here at this point in time. Mansi or anyone else want to add anything here? Aishwarya, she, as I said, she is leading a corporate practice from Silicon Valley office here, Palo Alto. So go ahead.
Yeah, no, just one point actually on, you know, debt instruments and Mauritius kind of, you know, this new treaty creating this interesting space. One advantage of using CCDs, the convertible debentures, is that when you invest in equity shares, the company needs to have profits in order for you to be able to repatriate your money back overseas. Whereas if you're using a debt instrument like a convertible debenture, you can actually repatriate your interest using cash flows of the company. It need not have profits. So that we found when you kind of do a hybrid of instruments, it works really well even from a repatriation standpoint. So this does open up an interesting opportunity.
Yeah.
I have a question about the...
There's a question here, I think, I hope everybody can hear. So it can be a little louder.
That's sure. So interest-paying instruments may be very interesting if you're doing private equity. Not very popular if you're doing venture capital. I expect the company to be having free cash flow, which to make payments. I thought I heard a suggestion, Bishop was speaking of, that you might actually just be able to put the bulk of your money in a form of debentures, sell the debentures, as a capital gains generating instrument, in lieu of converting and selling the shares. This sounds like the type of thing which would attract a lot of negative attention. Do you think this is a glitch in the drafting of the treaty, or do you think this has legs?
So, Manji, you understood the question, no? That if
yeah,
you sell debentures, possibly that is not covered under the amended protocol, right?
Right, right.
Okay.
So the way the, if, is the question about transfer of CCDs?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I think, Nishad, you alluded to this earlier also, the way the treaty has been revised, it reallocates the right to tax only capital gains on equity shares. And then there's a residuary clause, which basically says whatever doesn't fall in 1, 2, 3 above will be taxed where the transferor is located. So rightly, as you were saying, if it's a debenture, there is a sound argument to say that when you transfer that, there shouldn't be a capital, the capital gains should not be taxable in India. But one, in case of CCDs, of course, there's a regulatory requirement. They are compulsorily convertible into equity. So the question is, how long can they really stay outstanding? And at what point do you, somebody would have to compulsorily convert them into equity? Because currently, you know, there are restrictions on having optionally convertible instruments. And also, whenever you go down that path, it's that, you know, you have external commercial borrowings, etc. There are various regulatory rules that you need to keep in mind. So the purpose of considering CCDs as equity was that you will compulsorily convert them. So at some point, somebody will be holding equity shares. And actually, an interesting question that comes in relation to CCDs is, if you were to acquire shares right now, prior to 1st April 2017, then you're grandfathered. Basically means you can exit at any point of time and you won't have capital gains in India. But if you're holding CCDs at this point of time, and you're unable to transfer it as a debenture, rather you have to convert it into equity. And that conversion happens post 1st April 2007. Then the way the article's worded, you would have technically acquired those shares post the grandfathering period. So when those shares are transferred, there could be a potential capital gains exposure in India, because the shares were, technically speaking, acquired after the date the protocol came into effect. And the other one thing from a tax perspective, you have to be careful with CCDs at some point of time. It's a risk. It's not, I mean, it should be something to be aware of. Depending on whether interest payments have been made or how that has been structured, sometimes the tax authorities can actually argue that this was not capital gains at all. This was interest that had been accumulated. So those sort of situations do arise. But yes, broadly speaking, if it's an instrument other than shares, then we have a good case to say that capital gains will not be taxable in India.
Also, I think to answer your question, you know, even when you're structuring CCDs, we have to be very careful so that it's not actually debt that's masquerading as equity, because the reason why it's characterized as equity from a foreign investment standpoint, the tax treatment, of course, is different, but the reason why they consider it as equity is because in many cases, it did have the features of equity and it was going to be compulsorily convertible. In that you can't redeem. There is, it's silent about whether you can transfer or not, and there are different opinions around that. But even when you structure the CCD, for example, you can't have an indefinite term, right? So you can't say that it will convert in 30 years, for example. So typically, we have always recommended that you have a very finite time period, you know, 7 years or so, within which that instrument has to necessarily convert into equity so that it doesn't, it passes what we call the smell test.
Allow foreign investors to give it a loan,
yes,
that we're not allowed to do
otherwise. And which you're not allowed to do otherwise, or you're allowed to do subject to the ECB conditions, which are quite draconian.
So interestingly, two things,
and actually,
you know.
Another,
go ahead, man.
Sorry. No,
go ahead.
I just want to add that in addition to like doing the CCD route, another area that is going to be interesting and which has recently opened up is investments in limited liability partnerships. So for some of the cases where those investments are made, we've seen recently that space has opened up. Earlier there were restrictions on investing and you needed prior approval, government approval, but now that has been liberalized. So if that is the investment that is being made, the transfer of such partnership interest again could fall in this residuary clause. So I think what a lot of people will also start looking at whether an LLP makes sense. And this, in addition to this, this also has the positive that an LLP, as opposed to an Indian company, is not subject to that 20% dividend distribution tax that Nishit talked about. and also doesn't have the corporate restrictions on distributions that Aishwarya had mentioned earlier. So as opposed to a company, LLPs are fairly easy to operate, and with this constant liberalization in that space, maybe we'll see that coming up a lot.
And especially actually in the venture capital space, the typical structure sometimes is that you have a U.S. entity and you have India as a cost center, right, in your typical outsourcing type of structures. And what happens is because of transfer pricing rules, you need to pay on a cost-plus basis, which means that your Indian entity is always cash positive, right? And so the question arises as to how do you distribute that income to a parent entity because you're so cash-rich at the India level. If you were to do that in a company, that means you need to pay dividend distribution tax, and you're losing 20%. There's a 20% leakage over there. But if you set up your Indian entity actually as an LLP, you know, it's kind of a pass-through, and you don't have to pay that 20% at dividend distribution tax. So it's actually quite an interesting alternative.
Yep. Thank you very much for all the very interesting points. I think one or two points to add on, like in compulsory convertible debentures, say, two things. One, technically you can sell CCD one day before you convert. Okay, so that's one way of looking at it. Second, the buyer of that security, for him, the cost of acquisition will also be stepped up. You know? So that is why, so even when he sells the shares, even though you may be subjected, this is also another possibility that one needs to bear in mind. So these are very interesting. Second thing, thank you for drawing attention on that LLP. Until recently, India did not allow foreign investment into an LLP without very special approval, and generally it was not easily available. But recent relaxation has allowed foreign companies to invest in India through an LLP. Now, our LLP structure is slightly different from tax perspective than what you see in the U.S. In India, all partnerships, even general partnerships or even LLPs, they are all taxed at an entity level. So it is considered more like a corporate entity. So what happens is that this entity is taxed at the rate of about 34%. But when distribution of profit happens, there is no tax in the hands of the investor, zero tax. Okay, so, but good part is that there is no corporate complex rules that a corporate law apply. It's very flexible. And number two, there is no dividend distribution tax. And that was the biggest, single biggest issue for most of the companies that outsourced business to India. And therefore, they always accumulated lots of profits. And we have constantly been struggling, how do you repatriate profits to the U.S. because if you have to incur 20% tax on that distribution of profits from India, because as I mentioned, that distribution of dividend is taxed at the corporate level. It is not a tax in the hands of shareholder. Okay, so that was another major issue that we have been confronting with LLP. You can do that. Now, there is also a possibility that you can convert your existing private limited company into an LLP. Okay, only problem is that we do not, as of now, very clearly know what are the consequences of converting private limited company into an LLP, whether it will tantamount to liquidation of a private company and therefore some consequences that may arise or otherwise. But it may still be worthwhile considering that particular part to convert and see if there are consequences, how do you deal with them, or you pay one-time tax and stuff like that. So this is something, but legally it is permissible to convert private limited into an LLP. And LLP, as she mentioned, it generally has interest, right? So it is not technically shares. So again, there is another interesting part that what protocol talks about is shares, but not partnership interest. So again, there is another thing that we are looking into it. And but in a way that all these things are happening. It has created a lot of excitement, but there are also very exciting options available, and one has to be a little creative and innovative in the whole game. But as I mentioned, while being innovative and creative, if you're over creative, that could also lead to some different kind of issues. So, we We just have to have a discipline of knowing where to put a limit on. You know, it's a little judgmental issue, but
yeah.
It's very, very important that you've got full freedom, but it is your self-discipline that will really make your structure more easily implementable and withstand. But once again, our experience in India is that judiciary is extremely fair and independent. If you see today's scenario, almost when at the lowest level we are income tax officer, then you have an appeal process to go to Commissioner of Income Tax. From there you go to Income Tax Tribunal. Then you go to the High Court in a relevant state, and then you go to the Supreme Court. So this is how the whole hierarchy, usually and until recently more so, tax officers had an incentive to be extremely aggressive because their promotions were tied to actual collection. So right, wrong, good or bad, they had a mandate to collect tax. So around last month, our accounting year is generally financial year 1st of April to 31st of March. In the last quarter, they will call up and say, please pay some tax. You'll get refund. We know that eventually, but you do that. Okay. So, but people, you know, so typically there was a lot of coercion happening, and what came to be known even as tax terrorism, you know. In fact, I was on Bloomberg 4 years ago, and Krishna being asked, so I used that word tax terrorism, and I was recently on Bloomberg, and they asked me, what is the new thing that you want to say? I hope, I said that I said tax terrorism, the finance minister and prime minister both have acknowledged that expression, and I hope we don't find any new terms. We hope we have a better regime. So it became kind of tax terrorism became part of the common vocabulary in India. And but if you look at what happened every time, from tax officer to tax commissioner, about 70-80% of the cases went in favor of tax department. But when it went to open court, which was like tribunal or high court, 80% cases went in favor of taxpayer. So invariably,
how long did the process take?
Process took about, okay, yes. See, we believe in reincarnation.
Yeah.
So if you can't finish process this life, I say you can finish next. Okay. So, but anyway, coming, it took about 5 to 6 years by the time. But you get 6% interest. And 9 out of 10 times you win a case. So you got government bond, because this, if you succeed, they have to pay interest, right? 6%. What phone included?
How about the legal fees?
Legal fees are compared to, I would say, depending on gray haired lawyers, charge a little more. It's a different question. It's very expensive, let me put it this way. But not as expensive as you pay tax. Okay, so between the two, you have a choice. You pay up the tax or pay a lawyer fee. I think lawyers are more sympathetic to your overall situation. Anyway, this is on a lighter vein. But if you look at the trend, was that about 80%, sometimes 90% of the matters went in favor of taxpayer when you went to tribunal, high court, or Supreme Court, invariably. And they've been very fair, very open, very independent. And that was the beauty of the whole thing. So a judicial system has been, and now we are improving on judicial system as well. A lot of things are happening, a separate conversation we can have on some of this situation. And now there is a move to see that tax officers are incentivized only when the case is finally approved by the highest court or when it finally settles. So the incentive to be unnecessarily aggressive may go down now. And we are seeing a lot of good changes, e-governance included, and many other things are now happening. So things may change completely. And some of you who visited India about 20 years ago, you know how much time it took in customs department. It used to take on an average 2 to 3 hours at the customs. Okay, today we see some of those things in immigration queue here in the U.S. for non-U.S. citizens. You know, we all suffer that. But somewhat similar to that, average you have to consider 3 hours. When you land, 3 hours for immigration custom clearance was a norm. Today, you walk out. Just walk out. Some of you must have experienced that in no time. And all the form filling, access, everything is gone now. So things can change in India. Things have changed in India. And we are very bullish and hopeful that New India is going to be very different in the next 5 years than what we have seen so far. So these are some of the things, but I think open up to question. I have gone, and we have gone too long. It's almost 1 hour. But yeah, any question anybody has on phone, I think we should let them go after asking questions. Any question, by the way?
Thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session for the audio participants. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to withdraw your question from the queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, wait for a moment while the question queue assembles.
Yeah.
With the first question from the line of Stephen Burnham, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thank you very much for the presentation. That was excellent. I wanted to just verify also that derivatives are not included, including secondary market trading of futures, options, and FX. I wanted to reconfirm that. And also the new limitation of benefits clause, I believe you you're telling us that this will also only apply to shares and would not apply to a company that is investing in interest, in debentures or interest-bearing instruments or futures and options. Is that all correct?
Yep. Mansi,
yes, that's correct. Yes, absolutely. So the limitation of benefits will only be in relation to shares which are acquired after 2017 and sold prior to 2019. So you also have to sell those shares before that period. The conditions will only apply to equity shares.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. So, reminder to the participants, Rich, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one.
Okay. So, I think since there is no question, so we can. We were very clear in our. No, now we have a question here in the audience, but if anybody has on the phone can do it and we'll take them, but for the time being, please tell your name and...
Hi, I'm Jeff Hong from Omidyar Network, and
thank you.
With a question about the grandfathering clause, do you expect there still to be challenges under GAR or otherwise for investments we've already made in the past and else, or do you expect that the treaty, the change in the treaty, we have more... We can claim the tax treaty under...
Very good question, first of all. As far as GAR is concerned, GAR has been moved to 1st of April 2017. So all the transactions that have happened prior to 1st of April 2017 would be anyway excluded from the GAR, okay, number one. And post 1/4/17, GAR would be invocable. But interesting thing is, and there will be more, I think, clarification coming in, is that, one, you have a GAR in the domestic law, or Income Tax Act of 1961. Now you have limitation of benefit article in the treaty. So in international tax, we interpret the situation, and again, in context of Indian constitution, which is slightly differently done than the U.S., where treaty and the treaty law and domestic law are at a par, but you give precedence. In India, treaties prevail over the domestic law. There is a very clear understanding of that. So now, for example, you have a GAR in the domestic law, and you have kind of a limitation of benefit article in the treaty, then the treaty will override the GAR provision. Though they have tried to say that GAR will override the treaty, but it's constitutionally not, sustainable. That's what is how I feel. So, but yes, you will have to take into account GAR situation post 1/4/17, and therefore I mentioned about, you know, what you do, how you do, all that is going to become, and a lot of subjectivity and legal issues will be arising. But for the time being, I think you're okay. Any other question, I think?
For Indian LLP, sorry, Sada Chidambaram, more of a cross-border entrepreneurs. Indian LLP construct that's similar to...
It is similar, but not identical. Okay. What happened, let me put it this way, that I believe, and I, Jonathan, you can chip in or somebody else can chip in. See, the evolution of entities was somewhat as follows, right? Originally, you had proprietary concerns. Then came partnerships, or all general partnerships. Then came limited partnership, where one partner has to be a general partner and remaining can be limited partners. So limited LP, and then next evolution was perhaps LLP, which is, I think, mostly used by professional firms here in the U.S., correct? And then came LLC, okay? Now, when it came to LLP in the U.S., it's mostly used by professionals. Now, this concept was taken by U.K. and later on Singapore as well. What happened was they said that LLP can be used for any business. I do not know the exact reason why in the U.S. LLPs are mostly professionals, because no partner would want to take unlimited liability. In LPA, one partner must be general partner. Now, which lawyer would want to take unlimited and everybody has limited? Maybe that may be the reason. You can tell a little bit more on that, Jonathan, you can access. Now, I'm saying that LLP came up in the U.S. mostly for professional firms, and it was given for tax purposes similar status as like a partnership of pass-through. And then came LLC, I believe, again, you know the history better than I know, but it was, I believe, state of Wyoming which came up with this LLC concept first, and early 90s or maybe late 80s. And so at the time what happened was LLC is a limited liability company, you call it, and the features of this were mixed of corporate and of a partnership. And eventually, tax department perhaps looked at it and said, oh, you call this a company, but it is more like a partnership. So we are going to treat it as a partnership. Everybody jumped. Everybody is happy because corporate, the liability of everybody is limited, but you don't have dividend tax. So it became popular, but I understand at that point of time, all lawyers designed documents which ran to sometimes 200-300 pages to show that we have more features of partnership than a company, and created that, you know, that we have, so every time they have to go to tax department and argue out the case or present it, and eventually I believe tax department here say that you check the box, you want to be treated as partnership, you'll be partner. If you want to be taxed as a corporation, you can treat it that way. But I think within 75 days, you have to check the box, and for 5 years, you cannot change the. Maybe you have something. You are expert here. I would defer to you.
You get one free change.
Beg your pardon?
One change without approval.
Okay. Yeah. Approval. Okay. And that also within 5 years or for every 5 years.
I don't recall.
All right. Okay.
Maybe you'll get it go out here again.
Something like.
I'm not sure.
Right. But so here, you know, you have that option to check the box. In India, we do not have option to check the box. It is treated like a corporation for tax purposes, except dividend distribution tax does not apply. Okay, number one. But from U.S. perspective, and you can reconfirm, perhaps you know better than I know. From U.S. perspective, if you're an LLP in India, you can treat it as a pass-through. Am I right?
Yes.
Correct. So you have good structuring opportunity to, you know, look through an Indian company for U.S. tax purposes, although India will always tax you at the corporate level. Corporate, I would say, partnership level. So we do not have, as of now, LLC. We still have to learn from you. But we do not have the LLC structure at the moment. We have, so partnership and LLPs and perhaps general partnership, all three, you can treat it, them for U.S. purposes as a pass-through entity if you want to. But from Indian perspective, partnership, general partnership, as well as LLPs are taxed at an entity level and not at the, at the distribution level. Another interesting situation now that we are talking this thing, if you're U.S. LLC or LLP more so, now, whether tax treaty benefits will apply or not is another question. because the tax treaty applies only to the residents of the U.S. And resident of the U.S. is defined under the tax treaty as a resident who is liable and subject to tax in the U.S. Okay, now LLP is not subject to tax in the U.S. It's only the partners who are. Similarly, LLC also may have similar situation. So whether treaty would apply, because it is resident or not itself becomes a question. The resident must be subject to tax. So therefore, India may treat this as a separate entity and tax in India, and there are some complications involved. You know, sometimes perhaps for LLC, there may be still possibility, but LLC again is not taxed at the entity level. So how do you prove that this is liable to tax in India? And of course, then there are some further provisions that treat really that if your partners are U.S. resident and all that, the extent to which your U.S. partners will be entitled to treaty benefits are also complications. But where we have found very interesting case, and which I personally argue and lost the case, was in case of General Electric, GE Pension Trust. Now, if you have pension trust here, the problem was the treaty says that the extent to which you have U.S. resident beneficiaries, okay, the benefits of the treaty will apply. Now, this is public knowledge, so I'm able to talk about it. So when I argued, the biggest problem for us was that in the pension trust, there are so many beneficiaries, but some may have left U.S. and who has gone to Australia, who has gone somewhere else, and ceased to be, so we could not give clear answer as to what percentage of the beneficiary are U.S. and what percentage of beneficiary are U.S. non-U.S. resident, because at a point of time they worked, you know, the funds are from all the people, right? And therefore the advance ruling tribunal said that will not allow the benefits of the treaty, because we couldn't clearly say what was. So we have to be a little careful when it comes to trust and some other structures, really speaking. And one more point I will make, because I made reference to advance ruling authority. So we have very interesting mechanism called authority for advance tax ruling. Now, this is kind of a court which has three members. The chairman of the court is retired Supreme Court judge. Then we have law secretary and also the representative of tax department, director of tax department. The three people bench, but predominantly it is driven by the Supreme Court judge. So it's at a very high level. And if you have any ambiguity on tax, you can approach the advance ruling authority with your facts or potential facts and ask for a ruling that, okay, these are my facts or these are likely facts. What is going to be the interpretation of law? And they can, the advance tax authority, can give you a ruling. And once they give a ruling, it is binding both on the tax department as well as on the taxpayer. You know, so this is very interesting, and lots of people have gone for ruling. The benefit is primarily available only to non-residents and not to residents. Now, there is some relaxation for that as well, but in general. So whenever you have more complex case or something like that and you want to be sure of your tax consequences, this is one mechanism that is available to you. You know.
Applicable individually or
state? Any, whether it's individual, but he must be non-resident from Indian perspective. And resident Indian can go for ruling if he has to make payment to non-resident or something like that. So by and large, let us say it is available for non-residents. But you can be clear in, you know, usually it is, a ruling is given in 6 months' time, but sometimes it can take a little more time, but not like, as you said, somebody said, in 10, 15, 20 years, no. So that's the whole thing. And is there any other question or anything? Yeah, you have a question? Yeah. Can I ask her, Brenda?
Sure.
We have sandwiches and some food, so please don't worry.
So for entities in Singapore, let's assume that Manchi's position that there is going to be no grandfathering in Singapore possibly. For entities which are already in holding shares, yeah, is there a way to move them in? into Netherlands, assuming they have the ability to do that otherwise, house them under the Netherlands company or do something else, which saves them on a tax on an exit later, without triggering the indirect transfer.
Yeah, there are a number of ways you can perhaps work around it, depending on your situation and what gains are coming up. But before that, can we just distribute sandwiches so that, you know, people don't feel hungry?
No,
I think, and, you know, so
or we can just walk
food,
over there.
No, why don't you distribute? People have disturbed. At least we can give them, you know, otherwise.
What they would eat. And there are two types of, three, four types of sandwiches.
Okay, 5 minutes break we'll take.
Yeah.
Indian drink, standard time, 10 minutes, we'll start.
Sure.
Somebody is asking questions. No, Brenda.
Brenda was asking. No, she finished her question.
No, she finished her question. You wanted
to. Oh, you had a question. Okay. Sorry. Take your own time, no problem.
No, I'm just, so we have a private equity fund.
Yeah, evil ones. No?
And we are
Mauritius
fund.
Mm-hmm.
So we're the life science fund. We don't belong to involvement anymore. But anyway.
Okay.
So once the new regime is instituted, my question is, for LPs and GPs who are U.S. residents, how do you see the tax between the U.S. and India being worked out? Who will go first, or how will that be?
It is like this, that all this structuring is also an exercise of cost-benefit analysis, right? So, and in the process, if you're making significant investment, then it is worth considering all these structures. As I mentioned, and we talked about it, that if it is pure equity investment, you may have to take a call. When do you make investment, and, you know. But if you're willing to structure it differently in terms of convertible debentures or other kind of instruments, then Mauritius still is relevant. And, you know, one can look into that. And again, apart from Mauritius, the Netherlands is becoming more interesting jurisdiction as well. So we have to take a call. But all this is relevant if you're making sizable investments. If you're a pure startup, not by a serial entrepreneur can still afford to bear the cost and understand the sophistication and stuff like that. But if pure startup, we would not recommend, because whenever we do any structuring otherwise, first thing we try to look at whether the client is capable of handling complexities and sophistication. If it is not, even though it may be good structure, we say you may not be able to manage it, so better don't do it. Or you have some advisors proper or otherwise, then it's worth it. Because there are long-term benefits, but in short-term cost is pretty high of all this kind of. And cost is even getting higher now. So we are a bit concerned about that. So, but still, in larger scheme of things, it becomes very critical to do that, because if you do not get tax credit, or if you have some other rigors of tax, or even if you're concerned about protection of investment, you know, it's an issue, you know. In between government change, some regulations, adverse changes in telecom space, remember? Systema and other ones. Now, at that point of time, the only recourse that you have is to use bilateral investment protection treaty. If you're making sizable investment, then it is worth looking at other jurisdiction, unless US-India treaty for investment protection is signed when Mr. Modi comes next month, and something happens.
I was asking a slightly different question. We are a $several hundred million fund, so that's not an issue. The what I'm thinking is, ILPs are telling us to invest everything right now before April.
Mm-hmm.
April, which is fine, right? And then, but the other, my question is, once the fund regime is in by 2019,
mm-hmm.
if provided that we stay in the equity and don't do,
yeah.
we do some debentures, but
okay, primarily equity.
Primarily equity. If we stay that way, if we don't evolve new instruments, I'm just curious as to between two countries, India and the U.S., but
mm.
India will be charging, the, will be taxing us. How does that work between India and the U.S.? Because you're not going to be double taxed, right? It's going to be offset.
Well, the, currently there is a problem, but if the treaty between India and the U.S. gets modified, and if there is clear tax credit made available by the U.S., it will become easier.
So right now, it's
right now there is question mark on that because
no.
the way in which source rules are worded, the clear tax credit for the Indian capital gains tax is not necessarily available. And that's otherwise, why should people not invest directly from U.S. into India?
Yeah.
If you pay X amount of tax, you get tax credit here, be done with that.
Yeah, but also many of the LPs don't pay tax at all if they're from other countries,
that's
right?
Right.
So, there's a rationale
mm-hmm.
for a pooled investment from
the
QB
yeah.
based in Mauritius anyway.
Yeah.
My narrow question is for the subset who are U.S.
based.
LPs, then, you know, if there is no coordination, then that's going to be very unattractive.
So, you know, when you have a mixed set of investors, you know, you really have to create different structures. For example, mixed set of investors, one U.S. and other non-U.S. Within U.S., you have pension plans and tax-exempt investors, and you have, you know, taxable investors, and then you have top-tier two entities, and below that you have the Mauritius or otherwise or Cayman and stuff like that. So it depends on each investor, but you have to take, if you have multiple investors, multiple types, then, you know, we have to create multiple structures within that. But each structure we have to justify in the documentation. Let me give you an example. Typically, when the funds invested from US, they often set it up in Cayman. And below Cayman, Mauritius entities were set up. Okay. Now, somebody would say, okay, Cayman, and why do you need Mauritius? You already have Cayman. So the way in which we wrote down was that, see, enforceability of contracts is much better in Cayman Islands. Okay, the rules are more similar to maybe you see in Delaware or otherwise. Okay, interpretation is similar. So LPs are more comfortable with Cayman structure. They understand it a little better than Mauritius. Okay, so first for in. Like even there have been very good rulings, or at least, if not very good, at least, on governance in Cayman, you know. So we say that investors are more comfortable investing in a Cayman fund, but Cayman and India, U.S. and India do not have bilateral investment protection treaty. So to protect the investors' interest, managers decide that, okay, you better have it in Mauritius, because Mauritius and India have a very well written protection. So you justify from non-tax perspective. So Cayman is justifiable from non-tax perspective because investors are more comfortable and the system is more akin to or understandable by the U.S. investors. But manager's duty is to see that investment is protected. And therefore, you need a Mauritius. So you have justification on both ends and then you invest in India. So
I think the short answer to your question, basically, that the whole reason why Mauritius developed as a route is because there was no coordination between the Indian and the U.S. entities, and you weren't getting credit in the U.S. for the taxes that you paid in India. Now what is happening is we will probably see a movement towards, you know, investments through Mauritius, et cetera, phasing out, and more people coming in directly, which will lead to the Indian and U.S. governments hopefully coordinating on offsetting tax and providing credit, but we don't know yet, and that is the direction in which we hope it will go.
Thank you.
So your fund currently is direct from or through Mauritius?
It's from Mauritius.
Yeah, it's, exactly.
Yeah. And I think then, I mean, you know, if that does not develop, then you may have to create different sets of investors and have different structures.
But I was thinking like that you would be bypassed and go directly.
Yeah.
Why?
Because if you invested prior to 2017, you're okay.
Yeah.
Between the 2 years? Yeah. But that will be, you'll be finished investing by 2019 or no?
Sure, absolutely.
The problem in that 2 year period is that you not only have to invest in that period, but also have to exit.
Therefore, a private equity fund, that's
yeah.
It is.
And therefore, maybe one has to, consider new instrument or move to Netherlands or something like that.
As a fund manager, also thinking about your next fund and how you're structuring next fund. So that's why I have to think ahead, right? It's one thing to think about the two funds we already have. We were going to go into
when are you thinking of doing
it? We were going to go next year, but now we're thinking, what do we do?
So hopefully there will be clarity at that time, or at least more than we have right now, how tax credits are being.
Yeah, which is that's why I asked about the future, because,
yeah.
We are 7 years, 8 years
mm-hmm.
Old.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
In fact, Netherlands would be good to consider, because Netherlands treaty, at least as expected, is unlikely to change soon, number one. Number two, two situations will give you clear exemption. If you invest less than 10%, which often private equity do not, but co-investment may be helpful. Number two, that if there is an exit in favor of another non-resident entity, then also it's tax exempt. Dutch company selling to another non-resident. And if you have another operating entity, assume for a moment, outside India, that Dutch entity can sell to that operating entity, and then it can sell to somebody. So cost-based, the step-up basis can go up, But you'll definitely have to work a little extra hard to...
I mean, the LPs are going to be narrow.
Yeah, they will be a little concerned. They will be a little concerned about
it. It's a lot to digest. I mean, it's been in the works for a while, and it's now...
No, it's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
But every time there's a problem, there's a solution. So that is how we look at it. You had a question?
Yeah, so I was talking about people who are in Singapore and have already made investments in India, that assume that it's not going to get grandfathered. So if they have the ability otherwise to move, say, the Singapore vehicle or the India investment into a Netherlands vehicle, is there any way that they can use that in a tax efficient manner, or will they get hit with the indirect transfer?
Well, it is like this, that if the entity itself moves, there are ways to exclude tax. Because, for example, just as individual can migrate from one country to other, similarly, you can have corporate migration. Now, I'm talking about migration. Yeah, in some ways inversion, but they are right. So, for example, a company, if it is to migrate, let's say Mauritius company or otherwise, right? Now, the basic rule is that there is a company exporting jurisdiction and company importing. So, Cayman Island and Mauritius, for example, there it is possible to migrate because... the rule is that Mauritius should allow company to migrate and Cayman Islands should be able to accept it without losing its incorporation. There is a trick here, When you migrate a company, what is the consequence? Does it tantamount to liquidation and reincorporation in the another jurisdiction? So the moment you migrate and if the consequence is that it is liquidated, then the accumulated profits or the asset distribution, could entail either dividend tax or what you call capital gains. depending on the jurisdiction. So capital, the company exporting, so country exporting the company should say, no, no problem, you can migrate outbound. On the other hand, company that is importing, like Cayman, would say that when we are allowed to come here, and we will deem that you have not been liquidated. So without losing your existence, you have migrated like a human being going from one place to other, he continues the existence. But if that provisions are not there, then often it is considered, countries have taken a view that it is deemed liquidation. But once it is liquidation of a company, then the distribution of assets and the profits could cause some tax issue. Now, in the context of Singapore, okay, Singapore does not even allow the, what you call, merger of foreign company into Singapore. And there are issues to that, you know, and does not allow it to migrate easily. So you have to sell the assets then. So the issue is set up a new company. Now, for example, Mauritius company has shares of Indian company, right? If it sells the shares to the Singapore company, even the Mauritius company earns capital gains or dimmed capital gains, let us say, because actually it is a sale without, you know, actual cash to its related entity, then anyway, there is no tax on Mauritius company. So today you can sell your portfolio to another entity, including, say, in Netherlands or something like that, before 2017, you know. And then Netherlands can allow you more longer benefits of the exemption. But you have to bear in mind that you may have to sell it to non-resident or this or that or, you know. So there are two ways in which you can do corporate migration. One, actual migration, as I mentioned, whole incorporation moves from one jurisdiction to other, but both jurisdictions must permit that situation. Second, you can merge. Like in India, a foreign company can merge into India. Indian company cannot merge into foreign company. Although Indian Companies Act recently been amended to say Indian companies will be able to migrate outside, but rules have not come in at the moment. So in US, it is possible. Delaware laws allow you to export and import both. That is quite feasible, you know. And that's the way we look at it. So it is possible to do structuring. Number of different models that we can work on. But the simpler models are straight migration or by merger or acquisition kind of thing, you know.
But having said that, practically speaking, we don't see Singapore not being grandfathered. You know, hopefully it won't come to that.
That does seem true.
In fact, lots of people go to Singapore a few years ago in a panic.
Correct.
Yep. Because whether we should move, you know. Eventually, 90% did not move because there are complications, you know. And only those who had actual bases in Singapore, otherwise they mostly, you know that. So.
Also, cost of compliance in Singapore.
Exactly. That's what. So. So anything else? Anyone else? It's been great interaction. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Yeah. Eat your food, don't worry. You heard me before that sleep, shower, and food, at least I never miss. Even if flight is going, let it go. So if you miss flight, you'll get next one. But if blood pressure comes on you, it will never leave you. Right? So stay cool. But thank you so much once again.
Thank you.